Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Today's guest is cellist Carter Bray, who first rose to international attention in 1981 as a prize winner in the Rostropovich International Cello Competition. He has appeared as a soloist with virtually all the major orchestras in the United States and has been the principal cellist of the New York Philharmonic since 1996. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Very happy to be here, Joel. Thanks for inviting me.
I remember reading an interview of you shortly after you became the principal cellist in New York, and you said that one of the reasons this particular position was so appealing to you was because you were still given the flexibility to do projects outside the orchestra. And given the fact that you were coming from an active career as a soloist, you still wanted to continue to pursue those opportunities. How would you compare those two lives with each other, life as a soloist and as an orchestral musician?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, it goes back to my life situation at the time. This is back in 1995. I was married and we just had our second child. Our son had just been born. And I was getting ready to go back on the road for the umpteenth time. And I remember I had a three-week tour scheduled. And I was literally standing at the sink, washing dishes, thinking, this is not right. I need some kind of a life change because I'd like to be here with my kids as they grow up. And the phone rang. And it was Catherine Cahill, who at the time was high up in the Philharmonic administration. And she was calling to invite me to audition for the soon-to-be-vacant post of principal cellist. My predecessor, Lorne Monroe, was about to retire after, I think it was 32 seasons in the position. Mm-hmm. And it took about 2 nanoseconds for me to realize that this was an important life juncture that was really being revealed to me. And in an instant, I made my mind up. I said, Kathy, can I please call you back? And then I had a brief chat with my wife, but it was already obvious to me that this was exactly the life change that I was looking for. It would get me off the road to a considerable degree while still allowing me some latitude to perform outside of the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it's worked out over the past 27 years now. It's been a very good balance. Not just a balance, but also it's enabled me to keep my solo chops polished in a way that has helped me in my work in the orchestra as well. And I would venture to say that my exposure on the outside as a solo player has benefited the Philharmonic as well. So it's been a really very good symbiosis in a way.
So the balance worked out the way that you anticipated it would?
It really did.
Wow. That's fantastic.
As far as the two things, I mean, to answer your question in a more direct way, I find no matter whether I'm playing chamber music or playing as a soloist or playing in the orchestra, there's really no difference in a basic skill set that's brought to bear. And it all has to do with listening, really listening skills. And there isn't a lot of difference, except to a very subtle degree.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when I first heard that you were accepting the position, I was absolutely blown away. I thought it was such a coup for New York to get you to take that position. The ironic thing is, at the time I was teaching Sarah Chang's little brother to play the cello, and his mother told me you were going to take the position because she was friends with the person who was high up, I guess, and had reached out to you to ask if you were interested.
So. That's very funny. I mean, of course, it was a no-brainer because joining the New York Philharmonic in any capacity, of course, is a tremendous honor. And it also happened to be my hometown orchestra. You know, I grew up just north of the city here, and I was one of those little kids who was present in the audience for Leonard Bernstein's Young People's Concerts.
Oh, wow.
So it made sense on so many levels.
Yeah. You started out then in the Cleveland Orchestra?
Yes, shortly after graduating from music school. I auditioned for a rotation. Well, actually, I'll get back to that. It was a section position in the Cleveland Orchestra, and won that. And I was there for two seasons before I left to pursue a solo career. I was mistaken in saying rotation because at the time, and this may still be the case, the Cleveland Orchestra was unique in not having a rotating cello section. You had a seat, and that was it. And you didn't move unless you were the designated so-called swing man. In which case, you would move or jump to fill any vacant seat, except, for, of course, for the principal positions.
Wow, that's an interesting way to do that. Because when I showed up in Atlanta, which was 24 years ago, we did not rotate either. But it moved up when people were out. The section would either move up on the outside or the inside, and there are some other rules about that. But I've never heard of the swing man.
Yes.
Swing person, I guess.
I was the designated swing man. And it gave me some very interesting performance opportunities.
Wow.
Because my normal place was last chair. I was 12th out of 12 cellists in inside sixth stand. But I remember one time our fifth chair cellist was out and we were doing the William Tell Overture. So suddenly there I was playing one of five solo lines with zero experience with the part.
Yeah, the very first time I ever subbed with an orchestra was the New Jersey Symphony.
Yes.
And I came in and I was sitting ninth and I wrote in all my fingerings and all of my markings in the part. And then I get to the first concert and the fourth chair player wasn't there. Oh. So they just pushed me up to the fourth chair. And it was extremely uncomfortable because not only was I not a member of the orchestra, I quickly learned that by over-marking your part and relying on that, if you move, you're in trouble.
That's so, right. Yeah. Little things they don't teach you in conservatory, right?
Exactly. So as the swingman, that was always your position? It didn't change from week to week? Who was that person?
No, that was me.
Wow.
Listen, it has to have been because I was sitting last chair. It cannot have been because of my vast orchestral experience at the time.
So rumor has it, though, when you said you were leaving to pursue a solo career, that many of your sections looked at you side-eyed and didn't really take you seriously. Is that a true story?
No, that's not true at all, actually. It was a wonderfully supportive section, and they were sort of like uncles to me. They were welcoming and tolerant and patient, and most of them at the time. You have to remember this was back in the late 1970s. I was there from 1979 to 81. Mm-hmm. American orchestras like that were still full of men who by then were in late middle age who had fled Central Europe in the late 1930s, early 1940s. So they brought this particular kind of Central European wry humor with them, and they would love to make multilingual puns and converse in various languages and dialects. And again, I have to say, it was like having a whole section of wonderful uncles to sort of teach me the ropes. And they were when I announced that I was leaving, they were very supportive and wished me luck and were very kind about it.
Wow. And is that when you went on to perform at the Rostropovich competition? Is that the way that unfolded?
Exactly. Yeah, I was just sitting there in my chair waiting for a rehearsal to begin one morning, and David Zauder, the personnel manager, dropped a pamphlet in my lap without comment. He was just passing by and dropped it in my lap, and it was an announcement of the Rostropovich competition. So I looked at that, and I thought, yeah, why not?
Can you talk about that competition, what that was like? Had you ever done a competition at that point, or was this new to you?
I actually had. My girlfriend at the time, who was a pianist, and I went to play, this was in 1978, so it was 1 year before I joined the Cleveland Orchestra. I've done everything backwards in my life. We went over to Munich and played in the International Munich Competition as a duo. It was a competition for duos that year, and we won second prize.
Oh, okay.
To my shock. And that was my, up to that time, my only experience with big international competitions. So going into the 1981 Rostropovich competition was not a complete unknown to me, but it was at a life juncture and it was an incredibly stressful experience. I had just left this sinecure of a job to sort of jump off the end of a diving board in a way. I moved to New York and I started preparing for this competition. and flew over there by myself. And suddenly I found myself sitting on stage playing the prelude to the Bach C minor suite in the first round in front of a jury that included people like Rostropovich, Leonard Rose, Raya Gabrosova, Pierre Fournier.
Wow.
I mean, the list just went on and on of living legends of the cello world of the time.
Yeah.
And I just remember, I had next to no solo experience at the time. I really didn't know what I was doing, except that I knew how to practice hard, and that was about it. And I remember sitting there and starting to play and thinking to myself, okay, just block everything out and concentrate. Put your hood on and just concentrate. You'll get through this. After my second round performance, one of my fellow competitors came to my dressing room and he said, Leonard Rose would like to see you. And I looked at him and I said, what? And he said, Leonard Rose is out here and he wants to talk to you. And so I went up in the hallway and there was Leonard Rose. And he was very complimentary about my performance that I'd just given in the second round. And he said, Mr. Rostropovich would like to know if you would like to borrow his cello for the last round.
Wow.
And I hadn't even been officially informed that I was a finalist at this point. And you just imagine how this was overwhelming to me. And I just looked at him and I said, please tell Mr. Rostropovich thank you, but I don't think I could do that in good conscience. That doesn't seem right, but how wonderful that he's offering that. Of course, the subtext being, you're playing on a complete piece of and please, please use a better cello. So he said, okay, and he left, and I finished packing up my cello, and I left the hall through the lobby, and suddenly I heard a voice from above me calling my name, and I looked up, and it was Mstislav Rostropovich standing on a balcony looking over the lobby space. This is in the Salle Gaveau in Paris. This just went from unreal to completely unreal, and he gestured to me, and he said, got it. Come up. Come here. So I went up the stairs, and again, he was very complimentary. And then I remember noticing he had these icy blue eyes that seemed to drill two holes through my brain. And I realized that this was someone who, despite his affectations of bon ami and clowning around occasionally, was an unbelievably intelligent, perceptive person. And he was now training his searchlight on me, trying to get a measure of me as a person. And it made me very nervous. I remember I started sweating inside my suit. And he said, what is your final concerto to play? So I said, I'm going to play the Prokofiev Symphony Concerto. And this look of dismay briefly crossed his face, and then he hid it. And he said, have you played this before? And I said, no. And he said, okay, when you finish playing the cadenza, don't play too fast. In the second movement, when you come out of the cadenza and the orchestra comes back in, make sure you set not too fast a tempo. Which was, looking back on this now, some of the best musical advice I've ever received in my life, and one I've given to all of my students to this very day. But he clearly assumed that I probably did not have quite enough experience to perform this piece effectively in public, but he wanted to at least warn me a little bit about pitfalls.
Yeah.
I went on to win third prize in that. Uh-huh. And he continued to be a tremendous support to me in the early part of my career after that. I was so grateful to him. And I made a number of wonderful friendships among other competitors at the same time in that competition. It was really an experience of growing up big time. You know, it felt like being thrown into the deep end of the pool.
Yeah.
I had really no way of judging how I measured up or how I came across as a performer or anything, really. I just wanted to find out how well I would do. And it was simple as that.
Yeah. Do you remember how many finalists there were?
I think there probably were perhaps between four and half a dozen. I don't recall offhand how many exactly there were.
And then in this final round, you played with an orchestra and an audience. Is that how it worked, or how?
Yes, it was a live performance with the orchestra. It was the Orchestre de Paris, and the conductor was Serge Baudeau. And oh, this is funny. I'd forgotten about this, but as I just pointed out, I had just left the Cleveland Orchestra after 2 years. Even among American orchestras, one of the most intensely disciplined ensembles there is, and this was my first experience with a European orchestra. And I sat there waiting. I got there promptly, of course, at 9:30 for a 10 o'clock rehearsal. And 10 o'clock came around, and an argument broke out between the union steward and various musicians in the orchestra, in voluble French, of course. And it was like a scene out of Fellini's orchestra rehearsal. These guys were just yelling at each other while the time ticked away about work rules, I suppose. I mean, you're a member of a major American orchestra. Can you imagine something like that happening at 10 o'clock on a performance morning?
No.
It's unthinkable. Yeah. It's inconceivable.
Yeah.
And it took probably a good 20 minutes for things to calm down and for the conductor to be able to get everybody sitting in their seats and ready to make music. It was completely astonishing to me.
Wow. Yeah, that is amazing. And yeah, Cleveland, yeah, that is one of the most disciplined orchestras I've heard.
Yeah, when I was a member, we were only very few years away from the years of George Sell, when these guys had to show up in white shirts and ties.
Mm-hmm. To every rehearsal?
Sure.
Wow.
Every service. Yeah. Wow.
So I'm curious now that we've gone down this road. So you just left the Cleveland Orchestra. You placed third in this competition. What was your plan if that hadn't have worked out and sent you down the road that it did?
What a good question, Joel. At this point, so many decades down the road, I'm not really sure. All I can tell you is that I was extremely young at the time. You know, I was only 24, I think. No, I was 26. And I had no attachments and no family to worry about. And I did have a plan to audition for young concert artists coming up.
Okay.
Which I did, and I got onto their roster. So those two things happened within the same few months.
Yeah.
But I think if I hadn't placed, I don't know, I suppose I could have taken another orchestra audition or another kind of competition. I lived very cheaply. It wasn't something I worried about a lot at that point. I hadn't learned how to worry about my welfare yet at that point.
Yeah, I guess.
Ignorance was bliss, you know?
Yeah, I guess if there's a time in your life to do it, that was it, you know?
Precisely so. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to play in your cello section, which is a great section, and observe your leadership style, which was really compelling to me to watch how you led that section. And I'd love if you can articulate what exemplifies exceptional leadership skills and whether this was something that was learned for you or whether it came naturally.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first of all, I have to say I have a phenomenal cello section, and it's no exaggeration to say that any one of them could play in my position really well. They would do a great job as principal, any one of those people. They have a great work ethic. They are extremely sophisticated musicians and know how to listen vertically. They're all very experienced ensemble players. So they really bring a great range of skills to the job, which makes my job ridiculously easy. But if I had to sum it up, and it is something that I had to learn the hard way over years, is simply this: use your position to benefit whoever has the least agency in your section. You are there to act as an intermediary between them and the conductor and sort of clarify any questions. So you are there at their service, really, to make their lives easier, because of having come from the back of the cello section in Cleveland, I knew how difficult it was to fit in and simply to hear what's going on back there. Mm-hmm. So anything you can do to make their lives as musicians easier by eliminating a lot of uncertainty or crap that intervenes, that's the job you have to do. And that can be representing their interests or intervening on their behalf if necessary, or equally importantly, perhaps anticipating any questions that they might have and getting in there and clarifying things before it becomes a problem, even before it pops up in a way that might take up valuable rehearsal time.
Uh-huh.
You're there to enhance efficiency of rehearsal technique. And of course, a big part of your job is making certain kinds of decisions that bear on using your instrument to translate into music. And I'm conscious of the fact that they are watching me in order to match that as much as possible. So I try to make that obvious, and again, to anticipate any questions they might have in that direction, and turn around, go back, and let them know what I'm doing if I have a feeling that they might be wondering about that. And just to create an atmosphere of low stress and openness so that they don't hesitate to ask me about things or express any doubts that they might have about things that come up.
Yeah, you really said that so well. And I think that what really comes across to me in your leadership style is the respect that you show for everyone in your section and in the orchestra, and the way you treat your colleagues, I think lends itself to people feeling like they can play at their best. And if they have a question, they know they can ask.
Yes.
They don't feel like they're not allowed to pass questions up or
right.
have you as that intermediary. And I guess you are the one that probably has to count the most, would you say, to make sure that you're always in the right place? Or do you feel like that?
Let me put it this way. Everybody in my section has his or her strengths and weaknesses. My strength is not counting. I mean, I'm okay at it. I'm probably average. There are other players in my section who are much more reliable than I am.
Uh-huh.
And thank God they're there. And if other members of the section look to them more for guidance in that department than to me, I think they've made a very good decision.
That's funny.
But to get back to your comment, I mean, it's yes, of course, I respect them. And that's so easy because I really do think of us as equal colleagues, and I'm lucky to be in the position I'm in, and I just try not to disappoint them. It's every day I feel like I'm starting from zero and I have to earn the position that I'm in. I don't take it for granted, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting now that you say that. Do you recall in your time that you've been there how many members of the section you have been on a committee to hire?
Well, actually, at this point, you know, I am far and away the oldest member of the section.
Okay.
And I think I hired everybody except for, let's see, three people, I suppose.
Okay. Well, that's great. So you know how they all play, obviously. And
oh, sure. Yeah.
I'm curious then, can you articulate what it is that you're looking for when you sit through these auditions and how you came to pick the members of your section that you have? And I know it's not totally up to you. Obviously, it's a committee, but I'm sure our audience would love to know what Carter Bray is looking for.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's a committee decision and I'm just one voice in the committee. But I think it's safe to say that all of us are not looking for a certain kind of player. We're looking for somebody, obviously, who has great technical chops. But apart from that, we're just looking for very sophisticated musicians. And there's a good reason for that. The nature of the job, orchestra players have to be able to turn in a dime and be extremely flexible, because you can be playing something one way with conductor A, B, or C 1 week, and then the next week you can be playing with conductor D, E, or F, who are asking for entirely different things.
Yeah.
So you can't be stuck in one way of playing. I remember early on in my tenure, I remember getting the impression that a lot of the older players were sort of continually reproducing, you know, like how Zubin Mehta did something in 1987. And it would drive me crazy because it was very difficult to get them out of that script. And that's absolutely no longer the case. There's been a huge turnover since then. And everybody is well able to understand that because we did it this way last week, it doesn't necessarily follow that we'll do it this way next week. And they're fully able to understand that and what they need to do differently in order to realize a completely different concept in music. So we're looking for flexibility and an obvious ability to think for oneself.
Uh-huh. How does that manifest itself in an audition, though, as far as showing itself?
Well, we look for strong personalities. We're not looking for a cookie cutter kind of player who might approach everything very cautiously with the fear of offending. Obviously, it's a balance. There's a kind of batter's box within which we're, but it's, you know, it's a fairly generous size batter's box.
Uh-huh.
Within which we're looking for people who are stimulating players, who bring a good, obvious point of view to their playing. We want them to be playing convincingly. And we like to be able to hear hints that they bring a score knowledge with them as well, that they're responding to elements of the score in their head as they play, so that they're not just learning a part in isolation, which I will admit I unfortunately did in my very youngest years when I took orchestra auditions unsuccessfully. Before I learned how to do it successfully, I would just look at my part from my book of orchestral excerpts and learn that. And that's no way at all to approach this sort of thing. So we're looking for complete musicians who can play with a variety of styles, colors, articulations, a wide dynamic range, without setting off warning flags that they might be problematic when it comes to blending. That's also an extremely important issue for rotation players. They have to sit with each other over the course of a season, and it's a matter of trust. They need to be able to trust that somebody will not be constantly coming in a little bit late or a little bit early or hanging on a little bit too long, playing slightly too loud, not so softly that they can't get an idea of your presence alongside. It's a very subtle balance, but that's what people are listening for.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And given the fact that you've had substantial experience in both life as a soloist and as an orchestra musician, what advice would you give to musicians pursuing a life in a professional orchestra or as a soloist?
Well, as I said before, you know, they draw on extremely similar skill sets, and those all have to do with listening. You really have to be a good listener in the present in order to be an effective musician in any discipline. And I'm talking about, you know, playing at a country western bar too.
Yeah.
If you're not listening, you shouldn't be playing live music. It's as simple as that. Any rock musician or jazz musician will tell you the same thing. So that's number one. The soloists that are the greatest pleasure to play with are those who obviously are engaged with us.
Yeah.
And are including us in their sphere of awareness as they perform. Conversely, the ones that are the least amount of fun to play with are those who sort of envelop themselves in their own shell and are not mentally reaching out to us somehow. I would say to be a successful soloist, you need to bring, again, a very, very detailed score knowledge. And you mustn't come depending on the conductor to continually be your intermediary, you know, between yourself and the orchestra. You need to communicate with them. You need to bring enough of score knowledge to have some historical background to know, for example, what editions contain wrong horn transpositions, wrong notes, wrong timpani rhythms. You need to know that coming into the first rehearsal so you can anticipate that these need to be corrected.
Yeah.
The conductor may not automatically know these things. These are things drawn from my experience without getting too specific about it. And conversely, to be a successful orchestra player, obviously you don't need the same amount of detailed score knowledge, but it certainly doesn't hurt. And a lot of us bring scores to rehearsal just for reference. That's always a good thing. But you need to have a very good ability to anticipate, for example, when there's a horn solo and when they're going to need to breathe. I've taught myself how to listen to the intake of breath of our woodwind and brass sections so that I know when the note is actually going to speak. I can hear that, and I use that actually more than looking at a conductor's stick in order to judge when to come in. With many years of experience in the same orchestra, you learn quirks of individual woodwind and brass players. For example, our late, great, recently deceased, longtime principal clarinet, Stanley Drucker, I knew that he always played on the front edge of the beat. It's like a surfer hanging 10 constantly. So I knew that I needed to play slightly early on the beat to be with Stanley when he had a solo.
Yeah.
I know that in general, the French horn is an instrument that takes a little bit of time to develop the sound. So you give them a little extra room in your accompaniments. You always need to anticipate that any woodwind or brass player is going to run out of breath at a certain point. They usually do it at the same time. So you learn to make little marks in your music so that you can anticipate when they need that extra phrasing space or breathing space, things like that. You learn how to put a walking bass deep into the pocket so that you're not rushing the orchestra as a whole. Little things like that, you know, they come with experience, but they also draw on your sophistication as a musician in a general sense as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. That's super helpful. And what kind of activities do you enjoy outside the orchestra? I know you have a life outside of the orchestra also.
I do indeed. I'm a lifelong sailor and a passionate one. And I'm out there as often as I can. I have a beautiful sailboat that I keep moored up in the Bronx at the foot of Long Island Sound.
Oh, wow.
And I take a lot of time off each summer and I cruise by myself single-handed up to Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. And I have plans when I'm retired to take the boat south, hopefully with my wife, if I can convince her, and go down to cruise the Bahamas and places where the climate is nicer than New York City.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been doing that all my life. My dad taught me how to sail. I hold credentials from the Royal Yachting Association. So it's something I take very seriously, and it gives me a lot of pleasure.
Yeah.
I was an enthusiastic runner until a couple of years ago when I had my second meniscus surgery.
Oof.
And I thought, you know, I'd kind of like to enter my old age with my original knees. So I've cut way back in my running and sort of focused my fitness routine on a ski machine that I have.
Oh, okay.
It's a better workout all the way around anyway, and it keeps me just as fit. That's a change I've made recently in my life.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
My pleasure, Joel.
Thank you so much to Carter Bray for joining us today and sharing his journey with us, and thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Carter and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview cellist Brannon Cho, who at 28 years old has won top prizes in 4 international cello competitions and has been soloing with orchestras all over the world. We're here to serve you. So if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us at thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.